Gene Shin, sculptor and public installation artist, was part of the University at Albany's Creative Life Conversation series with me in the fall of last year. Shin is nationally recognized for her monumental installations that transform everyday objects into expressions of identity and community. For each project, she amasses vast collections of a particular object, prescription pill bottles, sports trophies, sweaters, lottery tickets, which are often sourced through donations from individuals in a participating community. These intimate objects then become the materials for sculptures, videos, and site-specific installations. Her work has been widely exhibited in over 150 major museums and cultural institutions. The Creative Life Series is a major arts initiative of the New York State Writers Institute, UAlbany Performing Arts Center, and University Art Museum in conjunction with WAMC, produced with major support from the University at Albany Foundation. This conversation was recorded on November 1st, 2018, at the University at Albany Performing Arts Center.
What is it like being an artist in 2018?
This is hard. Okay, what is it like? Well, I do feel like it's a place of privilege for me. I get to do this work that I feel compelled and trying to find meaning in that work every day. And in 2018, I think we're all looking and thinking about this recent future as we've had 2 years ago. So I think there's a lot that compels us to think about the impact of the work that we do, not only in our lives, but the future generation. So it's a little bit complicated as an artist. I don't think I necessarily feel that I can retreat to my studio, but that the work that I make out in the world has to kind of do something in terms of the politics and the direction this country and the world is going.
So your work has always had that theme of wanting to do something, of wanting to say something, of to start a conversation, mm-hmm. to bring people together. So I assume that is intensified and that perhaps the subjects become, I don't know, do they become more specific or do they become broader? I guess you can make a case for either, couldn't you?
Right. I have been compelled to bring people together, and art has been the catalyst, right, to say we're making art together, we're going through a creative process, I have a need, you know, and wanting to have a material exchange with people, right? But in that process, what happens behind the scenes is that people start developing relationships, start sharing their lives and their stories, and the objects are connected to their experiences. And so all of that sort of is an umbrella in which those experiences are housed. And then life goes on outside the project. But today I do find that communities are more vulnerable, right? And I do find that a lot of the ideas that were maybe embedded in the work seem to come more readily forward because people are consciously thinking about it. Thinking about when you come together in communities, who's coming together and who's excluded. You know,
right.
So those conversations are things that I'm consciously thinking about, and I think people are thinking about.
That's such an interesting point, because it seems that so often in art, especially over the last 2 years, that when a play is reprised and there's a revival of it, or a novel is published again, and they talk about the great relevance that this work from 1948 has to mm-hmm. today. That's a lot of what you're talking about, right? It's mm-hmm. it's that it was always there. It's just that we're now hyper-focused on it and also looking for examples of what has come before, which is interesting mm-hmm. in your work because you often use items that are older, perhaps, than we are.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, I do think that art should be presented in a context, and art exists in a context. Oftentimes we want to ignore the context and say, it's art, it's just by itself, and I feel like it's an object. It's anything in the world has a before and after, and proximity as well, and where it exists. So to look at art in context is an important thing. Objects, however, change meaning, and so does art over context. I think culture has a way of defining itself again and again, and using art and objects as well. You know, so I'll mention a piece like Chance City. I did that piece just for my impulse of what I was trying to create in the studio and so on. But at the end of the day, 9/11 happened, and I was talking about structures of chance and risk. And then the work really changed for me, you know. This is discarded lotto tickets, and I'm building a city like a house of cards.
It's interesting because that's a fascinating work. Talk about that a little bit, because it's, as you said, it's lotto tickets, but the value of them, of what it cost to buy them initially before we realized that they were garbage, was right. What?
So they, you know, every ticket is usually a dollar.
Right.
Sometimes they're $2 tickets, and if you're fancy, you get the $5 big tickets.
Yeah.
but, you know, for every unit, there is a cost value that is an exchange, you know. But at the end of the day, I think there's also an embedded, a non-value that we say is priceless, right? It's the hope, it's the fantasy, it's
a
the dream.
A dollar and a dream.
Exactly. To be a winner, you know, to feel like you have the potential right before you scratch that ticket that you could win. And you weren't qualified, you weren't any different than the next person who could have bought the ticket. So for me, there's kind of a democracy in that, you know, that anyone can dream and anyone actually could win. But the reality is that it's all fixed. Right? You're not actually right. Going to win. In fact, the reality is you're going to lose, right? So that's kind of the funny thing. And yet we believe that we're going to play the game, right?
So when we look at the idea of Chance City, so there's the idea of using the lotto tickets, but what you construct with them becomes what to you? Because that also conveys the idea as well.
Right, so it's a city, and it's a structure made like a house of cards, so it has no glue, and it's really just a placing one perpendicular card next to another with lots of patience and lots of labor and lots of belief that it's going to hold together. At the end of the day, it's building a city, really like a city of chance, a city of dreams, city of hope, a city that I think represents many cities, that it came out of labor and a lot of hard work, not out of an instant fantasy that someone had. And it's, well, some cities, I might say, can snap
sure.
its fingers in the world, but most cities come out of a much more organic process of many losers, too. You know, like it's the hard work of people who are not on the right side of that ticket, right? But the image comes off being incredibly stunning and beautiful, like a beautiful skyline, you know? So there's a contradiction in how cities are perceived.
You were talking about this a moment ago, but that idea of who is included and then who is excluded. And that, I mean, that's a wonderful, that piece in particular is a wonderful example of that.
Right.
We're speaking to sculptor and public installation artist Jean Shin, who is part of the University at Albany's Creative Life Conversation Series.
How do you want that exclusion to be articulated within the art?
Well, that project, I mean, the backstory of that story, of making that work, is I would see this lotto ticket every day as I walk from the studio to my home to the studio and back and forth. And I imagine, like, this, you know, if that was a dollar that I could pick up for every, you know, commute, I could make, you know, $15, $20. And that would be more valuable than the hours I wasted in my studio making nothing. Because, you know, so I realized that every day is sort of embedded in a non-value, but yet I believe that something was going to happen that was meaningful to me, even though at the end of the day it was time and money lost, right?
Mm-hmm.
So I was seeing that parallel that that I'm addicted to my practice and no one can tell me otherwise, and they can say, oh, you're never going to be an artist, and the odds of actually making a living, when you get a real job, you know, all those things that people would say to you as a young artist. It's like, well, but I still believe. I'm still going to make the effort and all that. And I realized that was very similar. My parents owned a supermarket and a liquor store, and that's how they made their money, being an immigrant. And they handled lotto tickets all day long, right? And saw every customer come in and lose, and they made a penny, 5 cents, you know, to every lotto ticket, you know. And so I realized the kind of a system, you know, that we're all part of. Like, they're in a certain economic and population, you know, and they had certain opportunities afforded to them. And then their customers also had certain opportunities afforded to them. And we're not talking about, like, a lovely supermarket organic goods. We're talking deep inner city Washington, D.C. in the 80s and 90s. So all of that really made me think in terms of, like, when I'm building that city, I am thinking about, you know, populations like, you know, the Korean Americans coming into Washington, D.C., and how did that tension exist for African Americans whose cities they were part of? And how did that feel for me when they're doing that labor so I can go to school in a suburban Maryland that's safe and had great public education? You know, like, that's a complex reality to build on, but it happens from the tedium of the day-to-day and the risks that they had to take in order to have their American dreams realized, you know?
So that's context. How much of that do you want conveyed within the art itself? Because we can come
look at it. Yes, I think the context changes. So I was saying that 9/11 happened and people are seeing vulnerable structures, you know, and imagine that structure will never fall, and then suddenly the wildest dreams happened, you know.
Right.
And then the same thing, I showed that piece in 2009. This was after the economic crash, and people saw that as a financial underpinning that's lost in our country and the world, you know. So it was read very differently, like it was about capitalism falling.
Roughly how many lottery tickets?
The last time I did it was 32,000. Is that what it says then? Yeah, 32,000.
Okay, so that brings
up... So we count each piece and I, you know, put them up together.
That brings up the question, how do you get your hands on 32,000 lotto tickets?
Well, this is where the resources of my own community. So I asked my parents, I was like, so roughly how many lotto tickets do you handle in a day and how many can you save? And then they estimated and said, but, you know, I can call up my neighbors, I can call my friends. We have a whole Korean American network here of businesses in Washington, D.C. who can save them for you instead of you picking them up on the street. So they did. So it was like about a year plus of them saving, and they'd reach out to their friends, and there were just, I mean, they have to clean up after their stores anyway. Their
right.
counters would be littered with this. It's just that would go with the garbage, but here they were collecting it for an art installation. So I had all these people coming together and be like, okay, can we stop collecting these losing lotto tickets for your daughter?
So do you come to a point where you're like, oh, could you push the orange ones because I need more of those?
I wish. But yeah. Sometimes you see the graphics, some of the craziest graphics you could ever, you know, the narratives of winning,
sure.
and
yeah.
The slot machines versus the funny satirical kind of things, you know. So yes, and graphics is so over the top.
But it's also very vivid, though. I mean, it's mm-hmm. it's bright, and it has that promise to it as well.
Mm-hmm.
Now, did you alter it in any way? So they're the people who's... Oh, okay. Oh, I
Not
said something
all.
Bad there. Okay.
No, I didn't alter them because they're just so beautifully scratched off. Some of them cleanly scratched
every single part of the piece.
And others just go, quickly, I lost. They're done. So I love that people have different systems. Like, when they want to lose, they want to lose right away. And others, like, I lost, but I'm going to scratch off everything anyway because I have nothing else to do. And, you know, I really want to feel that loss because I don't have another dollar. Like, they can't quickly scratch another ticket, you know? So some people were really, like, neat about
yeah.
their systems of loss. And others are like, I lost, throw it out. I don't want to see it again, you know? So I leave all that because that's human behavior.
I've seen this done two ways because I've talked to people that do this. I think it's fascinating. They have those bingo and crossword ones.
Right.
Now, if you play them the way they're supposed to be played, they can take forever,
yes.
9 days to scratch everything off.
Yeah.
So one day, I'm sitting in the store, and a customer in front of me gets a ticket, doesn't touch it, walks over to that little machine where you scan it, says, oh, I lost, and then went over and bought another one. And I thought, well, that's cheating, isn't it? I mean, you're not scratching it,
really?
But I guess it doesn't matter. But then there are the other people who are taking every little piece of silver off of that. Those variables, I would assume, fascinate you, because then it becomes sociological as well.
Totally. It's a mapping of that, yeah.
We spend time on that particular piece, but was there ever a thought to say, well, you know, if we figured out a way, we could keep this together if we wanted to and then ship it to Louisville if we needed to, but you didn't want that?
Yeah, totally. It totally can be an art object, and I could make sculpture in the sense of a permanence and actually create more value to the work.
Mm-hmm.
But really, I wanted to keep with the fact that intrinsically it could and should always remain a city of chance. And so its ability to fall and showing the work, you may believe that it may stay up, and a lot of the first times the curator's like, this is going to fall. It's going to fall, and then you're going to have to come back and rebuild it. And I said, and if it happens, then we'll do that, right? Or not, and it'll be a fallen city, you know? So it was sort of like we couldn't predict what would happen, you know? And sometimes people would give me less time to install, and I had to install very quickly. And so I'm like, yeah, I'm going to sit a little bit fast, and this is unstable, but you asked me to finish on time, and so it's a fast city. You know, so some of that is embedded, and some people I'll say, can you give me 3 weeks? And then they'll stay up for 4 months, because I'm going to take some time. And in the process of the work, its exhibition, some pieces will fall, and it's always the little low villas. You know, I call it like the suburban sprawl, like mm-hmm. they're the most vulnerable, but the core of the city is really, really extremely strong, and it is fortified by the redundancy. So like the engineering of it, if you keep repeating itself, it is completely solid, and it's really hard to fall. And I think that logic also helps me to talk about the piece, because what the systems that I believe, that if you come together, you're stronger than you are if you just go off on your own and try to, you know, do your own thing. You know, so I think a lot of those cultural phenomenas are embedded in the piece as well. So I don't glue them, because then that would almost be cheating, like you said.
Right. Do you, when each time you are building the installation, is that new, or are you replicating what you had already done?
It's always new. Yeah, it's new. A performance. You could start in the corner, and you have no way of predicting how far. You can try to plan a little bit, but it really is organic.
Is it painstaking, or do you enjoy it?
So it's sort of a zen process. You know, yes, your back is hurting, your mind is wandering, you're like, oh my God, I'm not done yet, I have to come back tomorrow. You know, you go through all of that, and at some point, then you hit the stride, and you're doing it for hours, and you're like, oh my God, it's lunch already, or, you know, and things are just flowing, and, you know, you're at a totally different level of awareness, and that's what's so beautiful about process-oriented work, but it takes a while to get into it, you know, because you wish you could just bang it out and be done, or just unwrap it and place it, but you can't.
Right.
The piece teaches yourself to slow down, to stop distracting yourself, thinking about those other things, to focus, to be mindful. So it really is a sense of meditation. Meditation, if you haven't done it in a while, it's difficult, you know, and your days don't afford you that. But it's also amazing if you can. So that's why when I started with the idea of, I feel like as an artist in 2019, it's a place of privilege, you know, and I see that time and the commitment that I've made to that work important, because I'd rather do this than anything else.
So give us a sense of something that you're working on now and that process. I know when we spoke earlier, you were talking about that you will make site visits, and I'm curious as to that process of does the site indicate to you, oh, whatever the case might be, whatever object, or does it, you say, oh, I have 87,000 ping pong balls, I got an idea.
Yeah, it sometimes can happen in multiple ways, in any of those ways. So right now I'm working on a project that will open at Storm King in May. The Art Center and Outdoor Sculpture Park. And so it's been an incredible engagement to work with a curator. So here, I mean, it's outdoor, an amazing site, so I'm really grounded at what the site will offer as far as exciting an idea for me. But then it's also really working directly with them. What's possible? What are they willing to do with me? You know, what am I challenging them to do to a certain degree? What have they not done previously? Also in terms of engagement with their audience.
So, it seems like the way you just described that seems like you're daring them in a way.
Yeah, I do. I never repeat a project. And again, it's like that chance city. It's never the same city.
Right.
So even though I do the site-specific installations, I don't do it with the same partner, the same organization twice.
Mm-hmm.
So oftentimes, and even if I do, the people have changed. The architecture may remain. So it's a very different conversation to engage them with. So it's trying to find the right fit. And their willingness to do a project. So I'm always trying to challenge my own practice, like have I not done? What do I want to do now? And then also what's an appropriate response to do together, because I have to have a willing partner in that.
Mm-hmm. What is that? Talk a little bit about that partnership of what ultimately you want from them. What's the dream partnership?
Wow. I've been never asked that. What's the dream partnership?
Well, you want the check to clear.
Yes. I want it to be fully funded. I want. I don't want to lose my shirt on it. I want to realize it.
Yes.
You know, in some way, I want people to be really invested in the process with me, right? From the beginning to the end and the afterlife, right, of the project. So that's hard, you know? Miss... Art objects aren't seen that way. Like, here's a loan form, sign it. You know, it's done. I feel like that's the opposite of the kinds of conversations I want with an institution. I want to build it together. I want to share the ideas. I want to be excited about having a conversation, and I want to share that excitement with a new audience.
I think that's interesting. I spoke several years ago. I spoke to the architect Frank Gehry. We did an event similar to this, and he said, I mean, he's Frank Gehry, so he can do what he wants to do, right? And he said, I'm always looking for someone who's as excited to do this as I am.
Totally.
I said, and I'll say it to you, I would think that wouldn't be that hard to find, and he said you would be shocked.
Yeah, I repeat.
Yeah, no, so that's interesting to me.
Well, I imagine, I don't know, he would be a difficult person to work with. I'm not the easiest person to work with either. I have pretty high demands. I don't think I'm unreasonable with my demands. I just feel like I'm okay doing the hard work, and I want my partnerships to also feel like, okay, we're going to roll up our sleeves and do that work together, and I'm not beneath doing anything in that work. But some institutions are not. And
right.
Some partnerships like, oh, well, I didn't think that's what you meant to do. Can we get interns to do that? Can we outsource that? And we're like, no. So for me, that's hard, you know, when you realize, oh, when we said yes, you meant like yes at this other level, and I meant yes all around, like it's a full yes. And so that's the kind of thing that they don't, when we agree to agree, like I didn't realize that that's what they meant. And I was going to roll up my sleeves and get to work. And they're like, okay, well, maybe, and then you see the hesitation, and then you see them back out, and you see the, you know, so that those happen all the time. They're a little nervous. They're a little frightened. They're now holding back. And I'm like, full speed, this is happening, you know.
And I guess that's the part I find interesting, because you would think that looking at through your lens would be, well, you obviously want control, because it's your piece, number one. Number two, it's going to be your name on it. And sure, they're the ones paying you, but they know also, they know your work. They know what they're getting themselves into. I mean, they know what they want. So you would think that they would sort of want to play the game. I guess I find interesting.
Well, I might clarify. I'm not sure I want control. I think I set up a set of controls, and I like to work within those
parameters. No, I don't mean controlling, but that you want to have a...
But I'm actually interested in more the path and the process arriving and going someplace. So that's interesting about the notion of expectation, right? And so I probably would like to set up the parameters in which we're going to engage, right? But actually, I mean, a lot of my work, like talking about chance and risk, I don't want control. I just want to set up the chances so we can really see what falls and what fails and what succeeds. And I have faith in that. Like, the things that are wrong and are bad will fail. Good. They weren't meant to be. And then other things will succeed and surprise us, and I can't predict what that would be. And so for me, that may be a criteria of like when a project is really successful, that I do something that I hadn't anticipated and I learn from the project and it surprised me. So that's not control.
No, but you're still the one in charge. I mean,
yes,
it's
my name on it.
Right. I mean, you're doing it. I mean, I understand that you want it to have its various functions of success or failure or whatever may happen with it, but it's still you creating it. And that you're the leader in that. So
I'm the leader, but I don't do all the work. I play a role as an artist, but I work with so many people, and like great assistants, great fabricators, great interns, you know,
right.
People who are helping to make the work. Everyone who contributes material, everyone who's a source for me, whose objects that are, you know, really part of the work. It's their object first before it becomes part of the work. Yeah.
Are you still where you can do what you want to do?
No.
Yeah.
Did I have to pause on that? Was that a long enough pause? No, I mean, like I said, I'm really pleased about what kind of projects I have.
Right.
But, you know, I'm constantly dealing with funding issues, and so are my partnerships. So
sure.
We're both burdened that somehow we have to exist in this world that's run by money, and not only by, you know, the embrace of the idea or the embrace of an adventure. So, yeah, there's lots of limitations and problem solvings and hurdles to go through. So I can't do everything I want.
Talk about the adventure part.
Hmm.
I like that word.
Yeah, well, I have been saying to my graduate students, like I feel like I've been in a process of free falling for a while. Like I set up like, okay, I'm going to get on this flight. And then they're going to open that door and I have to free fall down and hope that there's safety nets and that I'll land without injuring myself. And that's how I feel like what every project is, that I've somehow, you know, figured out, like, okay, so you're going to send me on that flight, so there's a pilot who knows how to drive that thing, and that's where we want to land, and then at some point the project goes, and then you're going to open the door, and are you going to jump with me? And they're like, no, you can jump by yourself, you know? And I'm like, no, we said we're all going to jump together. But at the end, when it really starts, I just go, right? And I just feel more confident, like, God, like, you know, you feel that, like, this is really happening. There's no safety net. I just fell off this, you know, free form belief that I can make art and land somewhere around there where I hoped, and that it's going to be okay.
So
that's how I think of that adventure.
But it would seem to me, correct me if I'm wrong, but the point where you jump out of the plane to the landing and you're alive.
Yeah.
That's the fun part.
That's the fun part. Yeah, but there's a lot of planning, you know? There's a lot of planning, logistics to get to that part.
Yeah.
And then the fun part is that process where you just go, like, it's really happening. We're really doing this, you know? And I can see the end near. I think it's going to work out.
I was going to ask this question earlier, but are there points... You were talking about times when you say, okay, this isn't going to work, and we kind of back off. Time-wise, what are we talking about in the process of when you know it's not
sometimes
going to work?
It's early.
Yeah.
It's better when it's early.
Yeah.
Better when you can show all your cards and you go like, you know, it's not the right time for you. It's not the right time for me. Our resources are limited, you know, or the conversation just fizzles. That's actually better than when you've engaged and you're on that plane together and you don't trust what's happening and you're kind of concerned that, you know, they said that that was going to happen and I don't see it out the window anywhere. You know, so that's
the
not
the pilots were drinking. None exactly. of this is good.
Exactly. Or you kind of go, there's no safety net there. They, you know, so that's complicated. I mean, every project that I do has a backstory that, you know, I wish that hadn't happened, you know, but we survived, you know, some casualties, some broken arms, but we move on, we heal. I learned not to fall on that arm again. That's an adventure, huh?
Yeah, that is an adventure. It's a good adventure. The opportunity that you have then to talk to students about this and mm-hmm. to teach, and how does that fit into your work and the overall,
right. So,
the overall project?
I do sort of think of myself as an artist and now an arts educator as well. So working with students and working with people has been part of my, you know, larger practice. So with students, it's like I want to have an impact, and I do kind of feel like my work could do that. But there's also a direct way in which I work with various people in the process of making the work that also seems to have a life of its own that makes impact and meaning for people. And so I realize that teaching is that other direct way, that I don't have to always do it through my projects, that there is a wonderful platform of education. So I really believe in that. And whether it's through mentoring or having relationships with the next generation, I think it's an important responsibility mm-hmm. as artists to do that.
Are you pleased with what you see from the students?
Oh my God, of course. Yeah, I wouldn't do it if I was not pleased.
Right.
It's exciting to see, you know, what new art's going to be made by this next generation constantly.
When I started to teach, I thought it would make me feel really old, but I found it made me feel a lot younger. Do you feel the same way?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean time, that's a false sense of security, but yeah.
Time passes very quickly, right? Because suddenly yeah. they're graduating already.
Right.
You know, and then you're like, what have I done? I'm still working on the same project, you know, to your project. So you suddenly realize that. But also then the connections where your students become your peers and your peers become, you know, like, and they teach with me. And, you know, so like then time also collapses. And then you stop marking that time. And I just feel, you know, great to work with young people. You know, there's sort of idealism. There's that, like, sincerity, questioning. You know, when we sort of settle down to our middle age, we stopped doing certain things, thinking a certain way, thinking it's not possible. And my students are always questioning the basic things. And I come home going, yeah, I should think about that. You know, and I also really feel like I want to model that. So whatever I'm preaching, right, I'm like, yeah, so today, reset that. Make sure that's happening in my life if I'm going to say that, you know. So, yeah, that it really keeps me honest, teaching. You know, and it keeps me really open to the possibilities of art. Like, it's not, if I was just an artist, I'd be doing and making the thing I like and only supporting that because that fuels me, right? But as a teacher, I have to be really open-minded to art that is, like, challenging and I don't get. And I'm like, oh, I've got to spend some time with that because I don't get that. And I also feel like, but then how do I explain that to someone, you know?
Which I assume you had to do plenty of times.
Plenty of times, yeah. So teaching keeps me flexible and fluid and open to any possibility. If someone calls it art, I want to spend some time with it and think about it, as opposed to putting a judgment because it's useful for me as an artist or not, you know? Because artists kind of go through and filter things out. You have limited time. Some things are useful, many things aren't. So you don't have to spend that time. But I think as an educator, you do. You kind of really need to own that space.
That idea of judging, how did you learn to deal with that? In your work?
Well, thankfully, my trajectory has changed so much. I mean, I started as a painter.
Right.
I think certain painting, even abstraction, shocked me. And then I realized it came out on the other end, embracing it, loving it. So if I spoke to my old self, and I literally have papers saying, I don't understand this work. This work is horrible. I only like this work. And then I look at that and be like, oh my God, that work is so awesome. I can't believe I wrote that when I was a freshman or a sophomore. You know, so you realize how much you change over time and how much art teaches you to be a different person. And so I think it's hard to be judgmental, because you're going to kick yourself and be like, you thought that sucked? That is amazing, you know? And so I think I would be a really bad critic, you know, because I think art teaches me to be better at looking and better at understanding other people's. And it's really empathy, you know, listening, taking it all in, not having to have a response. Just giving them time and space to exist until somehow it speaks to you later. And some works are quiet, some works are screaming. So it may not be your disposition, but it doesn't matter. You're just empathetic to give it time and space, right? So art's really great for that, for teaching ourselves to be the best self, because you're the audience to a work, right? And the work is different. Comes and is made from different people. So even before I can learn the person, the art may teach me how to like approach that topic. Mm-hmm. And sometimes, of course, it's helpful if you know the person and they make a work. That's an easier, you made that, I love it. You know, even if you don't, right? You can say that and really truly mean it. Like, I love it because I love you and you made this. Right. And this matters to you. And then it will grow on you, right? But sometimes it comes the other way.
I've been reading a lot about empathy, and because it seems to be, to me, what we're sorely missing. Can we use it as a catalyst? Can we use art as a catalyst to exactly what you just described,
to make it.
I don't know, as a way of demonstrating the possibilities.
I guess I've been thinking about it. I'm not sure I can articulate how empathy and art works. But yes, I totally believe that it does, and I think that it has happened in my work. Mm-hmm. I also feel like now in a larger context and talking about contemporary art and our history, the object can do that. So art, I definitely feel like, can do that. But then you have to question who is making it and who are you giving time and space for. So how can we be empathetic when it doesn't include all of us? Right. So this is where the canon of art history has failed us. Our present curators, museum directors, funders, collectors, the list keeps going. They've all failed us to say who gets the space, right? So we're hearing from the same people. Like, we can only be sympathetic so much of their problems when other people don't even get a moment to be examined, you know, so that their stories can be told and that audiences can understand and be sympathetic, you know?
And that's, if I'm understanding you correctly, that's two ways. For you as an artist to tell that story of those who are, for want of a better term, disenfranchised, mm-hmm. but also for those people to be able to
tell
their own stories.
Absolutely.
And create their own art.
Absolutely. And so for me, it goes back to the space of privilege. I'm an artist who gets to show in museums. How many Korean-American artists, how many Asian artists, how many people of color, how many women? I mean, I represent a lot. So when someone says, you're having a show, I'm not having a show of my own work. I kind of have to represent all that stuff, all those people with me who were said no, who never even got an invite, right? So that's a real burden to me, to be able to say yes. And so when I say yes, it's like, that's great. And so I'm going to bring as many of, you know, that context and people with me to that show, because they're part of the work. But at the end of the day, it's like, it doesn't feel so great, because I think in some way there should be all those invitations to the people who haven't had a chance to show their work in certain elite institutions.
I'll finish with this, and then we'll go to questions in the audience. And I hope I don't. I hope I say this correctly, but it seems like more of us should then feel burdened.
Absolutely.
I mean, we look
we
at that
feel
as a negative.
We should feel a responsibility to be representing, you know, the population of society, you know, and we're not feeling that burden at all. We've ignored it.
when an artist will come to you if they are female, if they are Korean, if they are young, if they are disadvantaged, and they come and say to you, "How can I do what you do?" I mean, there's no easy answer to that, obviously.
None at all. I mean, and they shouldn't do what I do. It's just
be an artist, make a living being an artist, right?
Yes. Yeah. Yes, but that is a really hard path. And that's the reality. Has it gotten better? Maybe. I mean, here I am on stage with you. I mean, it's gotten better, but
clearly.
but
there's a sign of success.
But I mean, that's the difficult part. It's gotten better, and yet some extremes have gotten worse. Yeah. And there's no progress that we can mark. But we can, as you said, point out what's going wrong, you know, until we figure out how we can talk about what should go right.
And that's a responsibility.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
We've been speaking with Jean Shin, sculptor and public installation artist. She was part of the University at Albany's Creative Life Conversation series. This conversation was recorded on November 1st, 2018. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC.